Okay, last week, as we ended up the session, there were many questions about the future. And I kept saying, you have to come back next week. You have to come back next week. Well, this week we're going to deal with the topic of foreseeing the future. For those of you who have been coming, you know that this is week five of our six-week series, and we will wrap it up next week. Can't say we're going to solve all the problems of the universe, but at least we're going to make an attempt to try to take a look at some possible solutions to the issue of randomness that we've been talking about for the last 5 weeks, 4 weeks, this week being five, the fifth week. All right, foreseeing the future, 21st century. Those of you who've been coming know that this book covers the full range from the Big Bang right up to the future. And next week we're going to deal with the topic of fairness. And we're going to try to wrap all that around, all the themes that we've talked about for 6 weeks, with speculations, theological reflections on how God might fit into the picture of randomness. Those of you who read Al's and my first book know that we tried to make the case for the structure of the universe, implying the existence of an intelligent creator. But within that structure, there are a lot of random activities that have occurred right from the start. So since the Big Bang, we have been there, and we've talked about last week 20th century history and all of the big events that occurred at that time, World War I, correct? The Great Depression, World War II, the Cold War, the rise and fall, and not fall yet, we're not quite sure, of Islamic Jihad, and especially that tool we call the iPhone and the computer, which has drastically changed our lives in significant ways. What has been happening since the 1960s is there has developed a modern futures movement, it's called futurism. A lot of people call it futurology and so on, but that's not the term that is really used by professional futurists who work in this area. And one of the questions that we inevitably raise when we look to the past and so many things happened that we were caught by surprise with is, are we getting any better at predicting the future? That's really the question that's out here for us today. So the modern futures movement, as we call it, started in the 1960s, where scholars began to apply the tools of modern technology to the study of the future. That's the way to think about it. So the question is, have we learned anything? What can we say for sure, one way or the other? Now, one of the questions that always rises when we begin to talk about the future is, what approach are we going to use? And so I've tried to indicate that there are some approaches that are excluded. I'm not suggesting that they're necessarily inferior approaches, but they just are excluded from the modern study of the future. Now, before I go any farther on this, let me just make one other comment, and that's this. When we study the future, we're not going to make a prediction about what will happen necessarily in the future. This is going to focus on how to think about thinking about the future. That's different than making a prediction that this will occur or that will occur. It involves how our minds work in conceptualizing and thinking about the nature of the future. And the reason we do this is really simple. The future does not exist yet. It's not here. It will be one day, and then it will be the present, and then it will be the past. And yet it keeps going forward. And since the Big Bang, we know we have lived in space and time, and probably space and time, unless there was another set of universes that existed before the Big Bang about which we have no knowledge, time probably did not exist. So it's created with the Big Bang, and that's the space that we live in. Now, the excluded approaches are what we frequently refer to as the pre-scientific approaches that involve crystal ball gazing, right? Or if you like tea leaves and you like to look at the formations of tea leaves to find out what's going to happen tomorrow, some people actually do that. There's also fortune telling, tarot cards, and also scriptural predictions. There are a number of people who turn to Revelation as a way in which to try to understand what's going to happen in the future. Modern futurists do not do this. That is not the approach that we take. What modern futurists try to do, and I've been working in the field of future studies for about 30 or 40 years, and I've been trying to figure out how to think about thinking about the future. So, and I'm still working on it. This is something that seems to be without closure. It's actually an open-ended process that goes on forever. Also, many people think, well, science fiction plays a role in how to think about the future. It actually does not. And the reason it does not is because it's so unrealistic. One of the things I enjoyed when I was a young person growing up was Star Trek. Beam me up, Scotty. I thought that was the most incredible idea, that you could actually go from one place to another by disassembling all those molecules and reassembling them somewhere else, or going faster than the speed of light, which we now call what, according to Star Trek? That is known as warp speed. You know, it's fun stuff, but it really doesn't tell us much realistically about what's going to happen in the next year or two or three. So the modern futures movement, so to speak, really focuses on techniques that are an attempt to realistically understand what's going to happen in the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years. You can set your time frame wherever you want. You can set the scope of your desire to study and understand the future. You can start with yourself. What will my future look like 5 and 10 and 15 years from now? You can apply it to the political area. You can apply it to social trends, economic trends, and so on, educational trends. And this is what futurists try to do. And in the process of developing and including modern futurist approaches, we ask the question is this. If we knew back in 1941 what we know now, and back in 2001 about how to think about the future, could we have predicted Pearl Harbor or 9/11 before they occurred? And then possibly intervened to prevent those tragic events that resulted in the loss of such high numbers of life. Now, here are four of the ways in which modern futurists approach the issue of trying to understand the future. The first is called trends, and this is the least complex approach, and it assumes that the best way to foresee the future is to study past trends and just simply project them forward. This is useful for actually short-term trends. Like, for example, what am I going to have for lunch? I'm pretty good at predicting what that's going to be, although I'm not quite sure because I haven't talked to my wife yet, who's sitting right over here. So we will work that out, but that's high probability kinds of things. The further we go out into the future, the less accurate we are with regard to predictions. Even if you're a weather forecaster, do you know how far you can go out? Maximum before you kind of run out of your capacity to forecast with a high degree of accuracy? About a week and a half at the most. If you try to project what's going to happen 2 or 3 weeks from now, the chances are that your probabilities and your projections will be pretty low and you introduce a higher degree of accuracy. So, and we also know that in terms of trends, what seems stable at one point is not stable necessarily 5 or 10 years from now, not at all. And when you think about World War I, the Great Depression, what we talked about last week, it is very clear that what appears to be a trend at one point does not function very well in terms of forecasting the future. Now, I want to make a distinction between prediction and forecasting. Futurists do not make predictions. They make forecasts. I'll give you a prediction. By the way, think of it this way. If you make enough prediction, guess what's going to happen? One of them's going to come true. All right? Now, I will make a prediction. I'm from Chicago. I'll make a prediction. The Chicago Cubs have the 50% chance of making it into the World Series. The other chance is 50% that they won't. I'm going to be right one way or the other. So I've already made a prediction. It's not the predicting that is the part of futurism that's important. It's being able to project future images that help inform our judgments in the present, but I will say more about that later. All right? So that's the way to think about it. Also, there is the assumption that trends are affected by factors outside of the trends that we cannot see. They're on the horizon. That's why weather is so difficult to predict. It's called chaos theory. One little change out on the periphery of this extraordinarily complicated system we call weather or climate for long term can affect ultimately the whole. It's the way to think about it. You don't see it when it's occurring, but ultimately it penetrates to the very core of what's happening and brings about significant change. So that's the first one. long-term trends are more difficult to predict or to forecast than short terms. The other one is called models and simulation, and this is using high-speed computers. Sometimes they're even referred to as quantum computers now, that are so capable of calculating mathematical values at such an extraordinary speed that we can't even keep up with them. And they're based, of course, on how the mind functions, but they're so much faster and so much more efficient. And all we have to do is identify the factors we want to correlate or run up against each other. They're called cross-impact. Change the mathematical values of those, and we come out with a different conclusion. That's how it really works. Now, basically, there are many people, many organizations now that use models and simulations. For example, meteorologists use them all the time to forecast weather patterns. And think of the early part of the 20th century when nobody saw the great hurricane coming into Galveston. How many people lost their lives as a result of that? 6 to 12,000. Nobody knows for sure. But now we track the path of hurricanes. And whether it's a watch or a warning, I used to live in Houston and we watched it all the time. When those hurricanes were heading to Houston, we all sat in front of a television and saw exactly what the trajectory was in terms of the 30% band where that potential hurricane could go. So tracking now, more difficult with tornadoes, but with hurricanes, we now can see them coming. Also, insurance companies use models and simulations all the time to determine what the costs will be for premiums as well as the payouts. A lot of organizations use these, and they're very, very helpful tools in beginning to get a sense of what might unfold with regard to where the future is going. But they're not perfect, and even those who use models and simulation recognize that there are limitations. They are tools that are helpful, but they're not perfect with regard to their predictive capacity. Then there are the experts. When in doubt, ask somebody who has specialized knowledge. Now, we see on the far right, who is that? Stephen Hawking. We know that he passed away last week. Stephen Hawking, 76 years old, a wonderful, wonderful contributor to our understanding the nature of time and space. And of course, in the middle, we know those faces quite well. The one on the left is Warren Buffett, and the other one on the right is Bill Gates. Want to know how to make money? There are your guys right there. They're two of the richest men, persons in the world. And on the left, of course, is Albert Einstein, whose theories of relativity are still very much accepted and under any experimental conditions have demonstrated to be correct. The experts, however, we've also discovered that in the field of experts, you only have about a 15% edge over the non-expert. If you get 100 people here and ask them to project something to happen, the expert has about a 15% edge. Now, the reason for that is the expert's knowledge is very narrow and very focused. And that's the trajectory that the expert will make with regard to a change in that area. But guess what happens? There's so many other factors impinging from the outside that they can alter that forecast or that prediction very, very, very quickly. So experts are useful. Simulations are useful. Trends are useful. But none is perfect, and in combination, they work pretty well together. And that leads us to the most important one, which is called scenarios. And what you see is a scenario cone. This has been developed by modern futurists. And you'll see that on the left side is a cone that goes to a point. That's the past, which leads to the present. And that point is the present, which then begins to fan out. And what you have is a cone here. And the cone consists of what we realistically think might happen in the future. But there are four concepts that are very, very important. They are possible, plausible, probable, and preferable. A lot of gobbledygook, right? But this is the way we think about it. We can think of possible futures, right? It is possible that one day I may fly without the use of some sort of artificial propulsion. But it ain't plausible. Not right now, it's not. Not at all, but it is possible, and it certainly is improbable. And maybe it's not even preferable. So that's the way to begin to think about it. Now, why are all these terms important? we want to make sure that whatever future we begin to work with imaginatively, because it's not here yet, it is something that really possibly could happen, and that falls within the cone. All right? So, in addition to being possible, it should have plausibility associated with it. If it's not plausible, then the possibility reduces in terms of probability, but it also needs to be preferable. Now, what some futurists will do is they'll envision alternative ways in which the future will unfold, and they will assign probability levels to them. It's probable that 80% probable this will happen, and 10% probable that will happen. But many futurists say don't do that. Because once you lock into a probability scenario, that becomes what? The official scenario. You think it's going to happen, and you lose sight of the changes that are going on all around you that will, in fact, alter that, at this moment, highly probable possibility, which is also plausible, the way to think about it. So some futurists say don't assign probability levels. Just watch the future unfold and monitor the environment very, very carefully to see the changes that are occurring. And the major five areas that futurists work with to monitor trends and changes are social trends, technology, the environment, economics, and politics. Those are the five areas. And what goes on in politics has a major impact in economics. What happens in economics and politics and in social trends and so on, they're all intersecting, cross-impacting each other. And so monitoring trends is very, very important in terms of how they could potentially cross-impact as well as steer the future in directions that we don't imagine. Now, here's the way to think about it. We live in the present moment, and the present moment encompasses multiple future possibilities. There's not just one future in this moment. There are many that could possibly emerge, and we have to account for that multiplicity of possibilities is the way to think about it. And training the mind to begin to think in terms of alternative possibilities is what the futurists advocate, rather than locking in simply to one kind of future and only one future, because what we might want may not be the future we get. And that happens over and over and over again. So we have a cone of futures cone that includes these four items. Now, what role does preferability, as opposed to the others, hold for us in terms of thinking about the future? Now, here's the purpose in developing alternative scenarios. Many different futures can emerge out of the present depending on the changes that might occur among the many complex factors that comprise the present. It may sound paradoxical, but envisioning alternative futures helps us make better decisions in the present. We can pursue the ones we prefer and work to avoid the ones we do not prefer. Now, the example I have up here is called worst case, best case. And we can envision futures that can be worst case, and we can envision futures that can be best case. I grew up in the 50s and the 60s in the middle of the Cold War, when it was expected at any moment the Russians, in that case the Soviet Union, could nuke us and we could nuke them. Right? It was called MAD. Mutually assured destruction. That was the year we remember diving under desks. You were trained at building little shelters under the ground in case there was as if diving under the desk was going to have any positive impact in the midst of a nuclear war. Am I looking at this right? Is something wrong with me? Now, the idea of learning to live with the bomb and love it, wasn't there a movie, something like that, Dr. Strangelove, that was a popular movie? This is called a worst-case scenario. The idea of a nuclear war is a worst-case scenario, and people got really, really busy to make sure it didn't happen, and that led to non-proliferation treaties of the 1970s and increasingly cut back on the proliferation of nuclear weapons. Also, here's another way to think of it. Self-fulfilling prophecy is you say something, and then guess what? It happens. that's also called a self-defeating prophecy, something you don't want to see happen. You work to make sure it doesn't happen. A self-fulfilling prophecy is nothing other than this is what the future will be like, and guess what? I'm going to work really hard to bring it about. And so when it's fulfilled as a result of your activities and initiatives, you say, well, we knew all along that's what the future would be. The future is not something that just happens to us while we sit passively by for it to descend upon us at some point in time in the future. We create the future. We create the future out of the images we have of how we want to organize our lives. It does not mean that's going to be the future we get, but it's the future we pursue. It's the future we want to see happen. And therefore, we become actively involved in trying whatever we can to make it become a self-fulfilling prophecy so that the ones that we don't prefer are the ones that, in fact, don't come to pass. Some words of caution here. Planning is not the same as futuring, although futuring includes planning, and usually futurists will develop alternative scenarios and then plan for the one that they want to achieve. This is because the future is not something, as I said, that we wait to happen. We actively pursue it. Now, outside of the cone, I'll go back here. There's the cone. Can occur things that are out of the blue. They're sometimes called wild card surprises that come at us, and we're completely unaware of them. And here's I Love Lucy, and you can see what expression she has. Yikes, where did that come from? And that is a good depiction of wild card events. And there are books that have been written on what happens if this wild card occurs, or what happens if that wild card occurs. So the futurists have been working in that area. They've been working diligently to try to create different alternative scenarios in whatever area they're working in, whether it's politics, whether it is economics, whether it's social trends or whatever. Now, what we've learned in the future is we need to do contingency plans. Although we include the most important situational elements when thinking about the future, there are many ways that they could combine to create the actual future. As a result, we need to be ready to respond to the actual future that emerges. We need contingency plans that take the form of if this, then that. If this, then that is the way to think about it. Corporations, politicians, and military people routinely, I love that tune. That's a nice tune. A very nice tune. But anyway, that's called a random event, by the way. This is a random event. It's a random event, and it's a delightful random event. That's my view. It's a nice tune. Okay. Corporations, think of plan A and plan B. You ever think in terms of plan A, plan B? Oh, that didn't work. I think I'll go to what? Plan B. We use that in our ordinary vocabulary now. It's become so common for us. Now, here you have a map of the United States, and in the middle of it sits the state of? Because why is that important to politicians? Every president has won the state of Ohio. If you win the state of Ohio, if you follow that as a trend, the assumption is you can win the election of the United States. And on the right hand is a group of military people who are planning contingencies. As they say, the first thing that happens in war is what goes out the window. Your plan on how you're going to fight it. You have to adjust to what the so-called enemy is doing or the adversary is doing all the time in order to be in a position not to be taken advantage of. So what have we learned in all of this? Using modern methods to think about the future does not necessarily improve our ability to predict the future. Why? And it's simply put this, life is just simply too complex in the area especially of human systems. Signal. Now here's a very important concept that's emerged. It's called the signals in the noise. The idea of noise refers to the enormous number of factors in any given situation that could be combined in any number of ways which we call signals. I'll say more about this next week when we begin to wrap this up. While we can envision many possible signals, we do not necessarily know which one in advance will out, so to speak. That is, become the actual future, in which case we need to be ready, as they say, to roll with the punches. to roll with the punches is a very good way to summarize how to think about alternative possibilities and probabilities and preferabilities in the future. If the future you want is not the future you get, the question becomes, have you thought much in advance about the future that you're going to get that you didn't want and how you're going to respond to it? It's very, very critical part of the way to think about the future. And so on. And again, I'll say more about that. And you can see the little diagram on the lower right-hand side here. We are all confronted with what? Go to the right, go to the left, go straight. Anybody ever see the movie called Open Doors, where Gwyneth Paltrow was in a train and a subway, and she could get out of the subway or stay in the subway? And what you have is a parallel movie script showing what happened to her when she got out of the subway and what happened to her when she didn't get out of the subway. I thought to myself, this is Futures 101. That movie is exactly the way in which we think about the nature of the future. What we think will happen might not, and the more we can anticipate different alternative scenarios of what is probable and possible, the more we can be ready while we are pursuing the one we want in case we get the one that we don't want. Now, how do alternative scenarios help us? And this is really fairly straightforward now. The mere act of thinking more systematically about the future helps us make more informed judgments in the now. And this is paradoxical. By defining current or different futures, our imagination goes forward in order to move backwards into the present moment, is the way to think of it, present circumstances and choices. We envision alternatives, identify the one we prefer, then act to make it happen, hopefully, although there is no guarantee that the one we want is the one we're going to get, is the way to think of it. So what do we conclude in all of this? We conclude with the question. This is the right way to do it. Ask questions and not give answers, because in terms of the future, it's still open-ended. So the way to try to resolve this is with more questions that help us probe more deeply into how to think about thinking about the future. So looking back, could we have predicted Pearl Harbor and 9/11 before they happened and thus prevented them? The answer is both yes and no, which sounds confusing, actually, but from the future's perspective, it's not, and here's how it happened. Yes, because both of these events were signals in the noises of their time. Both were possible. But there were also a lot of other signals in the events that surrounded the bombing of Pearl Harbor and in the activities that are associated with 9/11. There are all kinds of intel or intelligence that comes in from multiple sources, some of which are contradictory, which is exactly what happened in the case of Pearl Harbor and also 9/11. Some people say, well, the United States was caught red-handed in both of those events and wasn't prepared. The United States had intel on those possibilities. It was there. But then you notice up here what it says. No, this is not possible because these possibilities were only one among many, and there is no way to predict which one of the potential combinations would actually occur. And this is so true. Hindsight in so-called connecting the dots is always better than foreknowledge in advance with regard to how the many combinations could appear before we can look back and connect those dots. One of the things that happens every time there's a major event is you can predict. This is not just probable, but this is 95% predictable. A committee will be formed. Am I right? Let's investigate that to see what happens. And can we then do what? Prevent it in the future. That's a very good approach, actually, but the probabilities of preventing these kinds of activities in the future when we are surrounded by so much noise and so many factors that could be combined in so many ways, it's a tricky proposition. It's difficult to get our arms around it, and therefore we need to be conceptually, mentally ready to move with whatever the punches are with regard to which future unfolds. Here's one statistic that is very interesting. When people get married, they say, till death do us part. right? They don't say 6 years and then we'll part, or 10 years and we'll call it quits. But what's the statistic on the divorce rate? If you have 100 marriages, how many of them end in divorce? 50%. And what is the average length of a marriage in the United States right now? 7 years. Hard to believe. So if your marriage is more than 7 years, hey, you're in a minority. 7 years on average. Now, that changes very quickly. See, you connect the dots when it doesn't work and you say, what happened in this relationship? Or you have a boyfriend or girlfriend and it doesn't work out. What happened? It started out so well. And now look what happened. We're no longer together. These are the kinds of thinkings that occur all the time. And people don't get married and say, what's going to happen when I get divorced? That's not how it works. But nonetheless, we know that there is a high probability, in our country, a 50% probability that that could possibly happen. Now, foreseeing the future, number 12. This is the last, and then we'll open it up for discussion. And that's this. For better or worse, this is our human condition. Whether we want to accept it, it seems to be the case. And that is that while we can envision alternative scenarios about the future and plan for the one we want, we cannot really predict the future, especially in the long run. However, we can think of contingencies and be ready to respond to whatever potential future becomes the actual future. In sum, the future continues to be filled, just as it was in the past, with unpredictability and a great deal of randomness. And let me just say one other issue. By the way, next week we'll talk about randomness and how that relates to fairness and where God fits into that picture. So the way to think about it is we are going to be living with randomness probably forever. And one of the issues is, why do we struggle with the issue of randomness? And randomness has become, in the last 10 years, an interesting topic, and there are several books that are exploring it. And one of the ways in which we think about randomness is that, for all intents and purposes, and I'll say more about this next week, we are creatures who like to have our worlds organized. We like all the pieces to fit together comfortably and give us purpose and a sense of place and a sense of meaning. And because of the incredible complexity of the world we live in, there's just a lot of stuff we have to block out in order to just go forward with our lives. And yet it is precisely those unknown factors that surround the very decisions we make that can ultimately alter the futures that we all want to embrace and we would love to see happen within ourselves. So next week we're going to try to deal with the issue of how God relates to randomness. How do we understand that? And what are the traditions within our own faith that help us embrace this reality of our lives more openly, is the way to think about it, with a theological sense of purpose and out of a life of deep faith. I'll stop right there and we'll open it up for comments and questions. Anybody want to make a comment? Yes, sir, Tyler.
Contingency planning isn't new. Has academic futurism yielded any real benefits since it's become?
The academic futurist, this is a good question. Has academic futurism yielded any benefits? And the answer to that question is the main benefit is not in being able to predict the future with greater accuracy, but in giving futurists a place in the academy. In other words, there are more jobs now for futurists as teachers because a new discipline has opened up. I hate to say it that way, but it is really true. And whether it was foreseen or not, that certainly is one of the consequences of it. Also, there are a number of companies that have in fact hired futurists to sit down and think about what might happen in the next 5 years and then begin to integrate that into strategic planning within the corporation without at the same time locking into only one possible future which may not come to pass. I'll give you an example of this. In the year 1950, General Motors controlled 67% of the sale of all the cars in the United States in 1950. Think of it that way. In 1980, guess what that percentage was? Less than 30%. In a short period of time, that control of market share decreased. Why was that? Because General Motors thought it was what? Untouchable. What's good for General Motors is what? Good for America. The only problem is there was this little machine called the Corolla coming from the east, and the Volkswagen, or no, west in the case of the Corolla, and the Volkswagen coming from the east, from Germany and Japan, flooded the American market with some new machines which had a tremendous impact. And Lee Iacocca in the 1970s developed a so-called economy car, which we know of as the Pinto. The Pinto was a response to the changes that were being made in Germany and Japan with regard to flooding the American market with new types of automobiles that were better in gas and more economical and that families really were looking forward to. We'll go to Charles, and then I'm going to go to boy, girl. So we'll get back to you eventually. Charles, go ahead. This is so true. Politics can interfere with the realities we're looking at. And this seems to be the most logical choice that should be taken, and somebody who has a political interest that might go against that possible choice can negate that possibility if they're in a position of power to be able to do so. That's why it's important to look at politics, economics, education, social trends, and the environment, and so on. There are multiple factors that can impact the decision in the future. We are now dealing with the issue of global climate change. This is really signals in the noise, because the data is not so clear totally that we can have a universal consensus on what's happening on our planet. And if you lived in Minnesota this year, the idea of global warming wasn't such a good hot idea, pardon the pun, but you get, there's so much snow up there, so much, and the northern part, and in Portland, Maine, and anything north of the Mason-Dixon, and so on. But so that's how it happened. And there's a lot of debate on the question of whether our planet is warming up, even though multiple scientists say it is. There's also a counter argument that says, in fact, it's cooling off. If you look at the trends a little differently. Who's right? We're one day going to find out. One day we will find out. But this is signals in the noise, where signals are competing, and politicians can affect that very, very directly in terms of how they want to spend money in the EPA and everywhere else. Okay, there was a hand over here. Yes, please.
Mm-hmm. They were already remodeling the top school of business to a quadrangle. Mm-hmm. And so that's like 40 years in advance. Planners knew what they wanted to do with campus. The same with downtown in the arts district. It's planned.
Absolutely correct. There are many ways in which doing the future is planning for it and implementing it and making it happen. Mm-hmm. It isn't that everything that we envision is not going to happen. Is that when we plan it, put money and resources behind it, and energy, and decide to make it happen, it can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. And that's what we would like to see happen in the case of MSU and the conversion of downtown Dallas into a really wonderful arts district. That's a very good example of how you can think about the future and plan for the future so that you can make the future actually happen as a result of your own purposes and projects. It's a very good example, yeah. And there were two men. Is there another woman here? I'm going to do a male, female. Yes, yes. Go ahead, Susan.
Does computerization allow for many more scenarios?
Yes, it does.
It makes it a lot more even complicated.
This is a really good, the comment was that computerization makes the world more complicated. Let me add a little bit to that and say the iPhone has even made it more complex. Everybody now is an expert. If you have an iPhone, you can tweet on any subject you want. You can flame away like mad. Every teenager is now an expert. We now have so much extraordinary complexity that's emerging as a result of electronic technology. It could be that our ability to make forecasts that are accurate is becoming less probable than it has been in the past because of all of the complexities. Here's an interesting thought. There was a time when one person in the world was alleged to know everything. Do you know who that person was? Aristotle, ancient Aristotle, who who was a student of Plato and Socrates. He supposedly knew everything. I don't know anybody who could make that claim anymore at all. We're lucky if we have expertise in one area rather than another. I see like all kinds of hands. I don't want to deprive anybody of having a hand. Can somebody monitor this for me and tell me which one? Yeah, right here. Go ahead. Of a what?
A die.
Yeah, there it is. There
yes,
it is.
No, maybe.
Maybe.
What's written on the other three sides?
Boy, I wish I could answer that. What do you think?
The Son.
Oh, okay, there you go. That's a theological answer. The Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. That's good, good answer. Okay, boy, girl. Here's the way to, that's a good question. When you think about a single person, how many of you have changed jobs in the last 10 or 20 years of your life? Went from one company to another. That is planning in the moment for a job that you want in the future, but guess what can happen in that particular case? It can change in 5 or 10 years, right now. And, or it can change 3 or 4 times in a lifetime. It is now, the statistic shows, that individuals not just change jobs, but they change entire careers as often as 5 times in a lifetime. So what used to be, I'm going to be with the company for the rest of my life, is no longer the way in which persons go into corporations. One of my students at SMU just wrote a paper on the millennials. He's a millennial. He said, one thing we can forecast or predict with a high degree of accuracy is that I'm going to use this job to try to get a step as a stepping stone to another one or a better one. And when I get that one, guess what I'm going to do with that one? A better one. What's it going to be? I don't know. But I'm going to just trust that the future will be there. If I work hard in the present, something will open up for me. That's how you can apply it to an individual. Or an individual is looking for a significant other. They have found somebody they can fall in love with and have fallen in love with. The question is, will it last? And if so, how long will it last? And what is the obligation, the commitment, and so on? You can apply this directly to yourself by thinking of alternative possibilities. I'm going to go to somebody else, Tyler, before I come back. Yes, go ahead, Jim. Oh, it's sad, isn't it? Even if I work with the Department of Defense, I could not answer that question. But that's a good question. As soon as some new missile system is alleged to be developed that could potentially threaten us, the question becomes, how are we going to defend ourselves against that? And my suspect that the military at the Department of Defense is actively involved in anticipating, defining contingencies, if this, then that, probabilities and so on. This is something that has to be done on an ongoing basis, and the people in the Department of Defense and the Pentagon are the ones who are charged with that responsibility. That's exactly correct. I'll get to you next, sir, but I'm going to go to yes, please.
Okay, so if we're looking at developing our own futures, what are some good reliable sources that we can go to for information to help inform us on the possibilities without getting caught up in the noise of the media and the...
That's a good question. The question is, as we plan our own personal futures, how do we go about that specifically? And my response is, identify yourself an area that's of real interest to you and start looking for the literature that's in that area that's associated with the goals that you want to establish for yourself.
What do you look at?
What am I looking at? Yeah. Trying to get to next week so I can finish the 6-week series. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I heard Elon Musk, I believe his name, he's the founder of Tesla.
Yeah.
And he spoke, and it was on C-SPAN, and I don't know if he's interpreting, he's maybe not a futurist, he's interpreting trends. Mm-hmm. He's saying 2001, all, except for maybe rocket ships, everything's going to be electric, to all vehicles. And two, the primary generator of those is going to be the photoelectric system. And in other words,
Yeah.
And so, but he sounded very persuasive. He said even the tax subsidies that they're done away with, that's just going to slow it down.
It's going to happen. It's just going to happen. That trend has been actually in existence for about 20 or 30 years. The idea of the electrical car has been around a long time. If you own a Prius, you've got part of that. There are other companies that are already working with a combination of fuel-oriented motors as well as electrical motors. What's interesting about Tesla is it's all electrical. Now, we're in a situation now where somebody has actually stepped over that line in terms of a total electrical car. Now they're talking about cars that drive themselves. There are all kinds of prognostications with regard to what the future is going to look like. And that's one of them. Whether that comes to pass or not, that too remains to be seen. We have one more question. Tim, can we do one more? Oh, we can't. I tell you, when you got structure going in your life, somebody comes in and says, stop, let's go on to the next level, and that's a good thing to have happen. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you next week.
Yes.